Welcome back, folks. Thanks for coming back, those of you who made it back. We're going to introduce the next panel now. I'm going to start. It's Michelle Byrne, is the VP of comms with USI, Union Students of Ireland. Michelle has been on the podcast previously and has been plagued by us in terms of trying to get our make us feel a bit younger. Rory's 40 in how many days, Rory?
And
I'm the week after. And Niamh Randall from Respond Housing, Head of Advocacy for Respond Housing. Niamh has a long history as well. She was in Simon and she was also in Merchants Quay, Ireland. I'm going to skip the next guy because his ego is mad at the moment. We have Michael Taft, researcher and economist with SIP2. And more importantly, actually, one of the best commentators. If you haven't checked out Notes on the Front, the blog posts, it is a terrific resource, and I would recommend it to everybody. And I will come back to him because he was recently described by Miriam O'Callaghan as the foremost expert in housing in the world. Was it?
Wow. She does gush quite a lot. In fairness. I just take that with a pinch of salt.
Dr. Doom, Professor Larkin, sir, is here from DIT, the housing professor, or Dr. Larkin?
Larkin will do. Thanks, Tom.
No, look, this is, Rory's right. We set up Reboot. We set up the Tortoise Shack. We were looking around saying there's nothing else. Too much sameness. What are we going to do? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to look at something different, look for solutions, look for things that we could actually bring out to people and maybe reach out and get a bit of a change some minds. So we're really grateful that this has gained an audience. I'm really grateful for the people who are listening, subscribing, sharing. But more importantly, we're actually grateful that we get to meet these great people. So, Michelle, I'm going to come and start with you because really now it is true. We're seeing it filter from the bottom up. Raise the roof, the housing issue. Students were out a few years ago. You know, students were marching and everybody's looking at the students going, ah, sure, that's what they do when they're young. But now we're seeing the student units that were effectively co-living, luxury student accommodation is becoming executive co-living and people are waking up to it. So you were kind of ahead of the curve, in the USI and in the movements there. Do you mind sharing with the listeners and the people here why you guys think it's so important that students actually have a voice at the table?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I suppose where this like really came into the kind of the national view was actually during the census. They recorded the number of homeless that night, and 8% of the student or the people that were recorded that night as homeless were students. There was over 420 students homeless that night, and there's also that's the people who are willing to call themselves homeless. We know that students are couch surfing or they're commuting long hours, and they're not being recorded in those numbers either. But since then, the government have come out and they've launched their national student accommodation strategy, which is great, and they actually acknowledged that there's 23,000 beds short there last year for students alone. At this year, it's going to be 26,000 beds short. And even if that strategy builds all of the beds that they said they're going to build, we're going to be 16,000 beds short. So it's just when you put the numbers onto it, and the government have this in their own strategy themselves, like, it's just bizarre. And when we look at it as well, like, the student numbers are increasing 2% every single year, and they have been for the last 10 years and they will for the next 10 years. So it's only going to get worse before it gets any way better. Yeah. And I suppose, like, there's so many different parts of the housing crisis and how it affects students. So you mentioned, like, the luxury student accommodation piece, but there's also, like, the problems with digs and then the problems with the private rental sector as well and how students fit into those as well. But particularly with the purpose-built student accommodation, like, you'd be forgiven looking around Dublin in a city to know that, oh, look at all these bills, like, surely there's enough there for you and all of that. But it's luxury accommodation that we can't afford. We never asked for luxury accommodation. We don't want cinemas. We don't want bowling alleys in our house. We literally just want fit for purpose student accommodation that's affordable. There's no way we can afford these €1,000 a month plus rent. That's the starting price for most of them. And it's just madness. Like, it's absolutely madness. And I suppose what we're seeing now is just there last month, Dublin City Council actually released a report that said that 80% of the people in those luxury accommodation blocks are actually international students. So we're not actually catering for domestic students here. And the government don't really seem to care about that. They're actually, in fact, it suits them down to the ground because the higher education system itself is chronically underfunded. Like, the fees have doubled since 2011 up to €3,000 a year. That's bringing us up to the second highest fees in Europe. On top of that, then all the grants were slashed in 2012's budget. The international students, today bring in loads of fees to help plug all of that funding gap that the government have started to cut and not willing to invest in the actual colleges themselves. So it suits the government down to the ground to have lots of international students coming over, paying extortionate fees, getting absolutely ripped off. And then on top of that, trying to manage to pay the €1,000 plus a month in these blocks. Like, it's actually madness. And I know Lorcan here on the panel with me as well featured in a documentary about students in TUD there last month. And one of the cases that was highlighted and actually was a Danish student. And that Danish student had come over and was absolutely shocked at the fact that she was paying €1,200 for a month for student accommodation, where she said... for to live in a block or in an apartment with five other people sharing one kitchen. And she said, I could get my own apartment, two-bed apartment, for €800 in Denmark. And she said, I'm actually, like, shocked coming over here. And the only reason that she can afford it is because the Danish government give them massive grants to study internationally. Otherwise, there's no way she'd be able to do it. So it's mad how we're seeing that. But, like, obviously, with the purpose-built student accommodation, as much as it's massively extortionate prices... You've probably heard a lot recently around the legislation that's just going through the Dáil just there last night around rent pressure zones and the residential tenancies bill. Like, students are included in that, and not for enough of us, like, shouting and roaring about it for the last year trying to get...
Took a while.
Yeah, it took a while. So it was this time last year when we saw Shanoan Shakedown and Kurt Nakorub going on strikes because just outside DCU there was a rent hike of 20% year on year in one private block just outside DCU, and in Galway... There was another one, I think it was 18%, like some massive rent hikes year on year. And actually the one in DCU were like given a week's notice or something on whether they wanted to uptake that lovely offer of a massive increase of well over 20% in most of the rooms. So obviously then the conversation for the rent pressure zones came in. We needed the 4%. And why wasn't it already included? Like,
well, you know why. With the same reason why when they talk about let's not give them tenant agreements, let's give them licences. This is the sort of stuff we're facing now. I'm going to skip to Lorcan for a second because you've just mentioned that he was involved in that documentary. But it also strikes me, Lorcan, that when we sat down, we started, and you came into the room and we actually had a tortoise walking around, and you were looked like not as scared as you look now. I remember you said to me that this was the way it was going to go, and you said that we had already undergone a generational change in home ownership. Rental accommodation and how things were managed before we in the last 10 years, and we hadn't even noticed it yet.
Yeah, if I could just bring us back really, really quickly. Emmett's the chancellor who was speaking earlier, and he's really good, and he brought up some really good points. So what we have at the moment is a Thatcher-like existence going on in the government at the moment. We've always had housing crises, always in the 50s, 70s, whatever. We've had in different ways and forms. The difference between now and then is in those days, we kind of solved them internally. We solved them ourselves. And with this crisis, we've turned to international money, which moves around wherever there's a gap, and we've turned to the market to solve that. And that's a real issue. And the job of the government or the state, as I see it, is to protect, particularly in economies like ours, is to protect people like us, the citizens, from the worst excesses of the free market. And right now, they're not doing that. And there's a couple of reasons why they're not doing that. And I will get to the student housing in a second. But at the root cause of the housing crisis are two real things. One is the lack of social housing. Without a doubt. I mean, the lack of social housing has having knock-on effects on all sorts of other areas, including the rental sector, obviously. In a couple of years, the Department of Finance have calculated we're going to be spending, Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, about a children's hospital, nearly the cost of a children's hospital every year in rent, some form, different forms of rent supplement. And nobody's kind of shouting about that. They shout about the children's hospital. But we're going to spend nearly that every year in different forms of rent supplement. So that's one thing. So we're not producing enough social housing. And we're relying on the private market to do that. And the second part, which is come back to Michelle's, is about how policy is diverting whatever activity is going on. Planning policy, and I know you think planning has nothing to do with this. Planning has everything to do with this, right? Planning has policy has changed to make it attractive to build units that we're talking about, the Bartra stuff out in Dunleary, the small 216.5 square metres, smaller than a disabled car parking space, rooms with pull-down beds. The planning policy has made that happen. It has made student housing happen. It has lowered the standards for normal apartments. But mostly what it has done is made those type of really small, horrible, dysfunctional places to live really, really lucrative. And money follows where there is money to be made. The banks will now only fund developments that make loads of money, which are the small co-living kind of units, student accommodation, and anything that's rental. It will not fund apartments or houses for sale. So we have created, inadvertently, we've diverted all the money into those extremely lucrative, where you can get five beds into what used to be a two-bed apartment and one kitchen for 38 people. Can you imagine the mayhem when somebody leaves the fridge open or doesn't clean up after all that? Like, this is just going to be a disaster.
Did
of
you use my butter,
all.
Larkin? Is this your way of telling me you use my butter?
Indeed, yeah. I had my name on it, though. So there's anybody who's lived in student accommodation, and I did myself. I lived in Manchester years ago in student accommodation. And it's just, unless you have a really, really functional bunch of people with you, and I did. The only problem was the Korean guy who kept putting frog's legs in the fridge, which was rank. But anyway, so we've diverted. Like, planning policy has been changed to allow these things to become incredibly lucrative. At the back end of that, then... the state isn't providing social housing. And we hear an awful lot of this stuff about cuckoo funds, right? These are investment funds going in, buying up houses before they hit the market. They're in the halfpenny place, but the state are your worst enemy in terms of buying up houses under your noses. I calculated a couple of weeks ago, and was in the Indo on Monday, the state is buying up about 18% of all brand new houses and apartments around the country. And that varies from 80% of all new houses and apartments in Kilkenny to 3 or 4% in Dunleary, which is fine. In Longford, last year, the local authority managed to buy 47 scheme houses, we call them, housing estate houses and apartments, even though there was only 16 built. Right. So the numbers are all over the place. Okay. But however, what you find is that the government is buying up nearly 20% of all new houses and apartments. That's a real problem. The problem with the policy changes that make the co-living and PRS stuff really lucrative is we're driving a whole generation of people, probably loads of you guys, into renting forever. You cannot, you only take one thing away from tonight, okay? You cannot live forever renting in Ireland. You think about it, it's flexible, it's fun, it's grand, okay? Can you bring up kids in it? Who knows? A lot of people do. You don't really have security tenure in Ireland, but when you hit 65, and I know we're all a long way from 65, it's rapidly approaching it, but when you hit 65, and even if you're a public sector worker and you're on 80 grand a year, okay, you're doing well, that'll go to about 42 grand overnight. Your rent isn't going to go down by 50%. So it is really, really difficult. Your house is your wealth in Ireland, and we are diverting a whole load of people away from accumulating wealth and creating huge wealth inequality.
Niamh, before I go to you, there was another man found, a homeless person found dead in Bray last night, confirmed today. Jerry, am I right? Yeah. So another person has died on the streets. Another person who was, there's almost a hierarchy of misery. And Niamh, I know I'm talking to you specifically because you've seen it from all aspects. You've been in Merchants Quay. You've been with the Simon community. You're now with Respond Housing. Do you want, like, when do we shout stop? How do we fix this?
I mean, I think that's the real issue, is that there are people really suffering, and people talk about markets and they talk about units and they talk about, you know, these kind of commodities, and it's the commodification of housing. What we need to bring back is putting people right back at the heart of housing policy, and we need to be talking about homes for people, because that's where it really needs to be. And we're not alone in Ireland with this commodification. I think it was Aisling who said earlier and spoke about other movements in different parts of the world. This is happening in lots of other countries at the same time. And this idea that we can speculate in the housing market and speculate with land, and to the detriment of people. And then the result of that is people living in really difficult circumstances. We have over 10,000 people who are in emergency accommodation right now. And we need to be very, very clear what those numbers count and what they don't count. It's a specific count, because you often hear people saying, oh, there's 10,000 people who are homeless. It's 10,000 people who are in accommodation funded through Section 10 of the 1988 Housing Act. So it's a very specific type of funding stream. So it means it doesn't include women and children or other adults in domestic violent refuges. It doesn't include people in direct provision. It doesn't include hidden homeless. So people have no choice but to share couches in people's homes. People spend a long time cycling around in different parts. There's also the reclassified families now that we have. So if you've got your own door emergency accommodation but you don't have a tenancy, you're no longer counted in these figures that are released every month. So the problem is much, much greater. There are huge numbers of people living in huge difficulty, people living in the private rental sector, and Lurkin talked about some of that, but living in fear and trepidation that they're going to get that letter that letter that's given them a notice to quit, and it might be a legal letter giving them a notice to quit, but they know that they can go nowhere else, that there are no other options out there. And the Residential Tenancies Act that Michelle referred to was a real opportunity to look at enhancing security of tenure, because if we're going to accept that the private rental sector is somewhere that people are going to live in the longer term in Ireland, well, then we need to put provision within that to ensure people have security of tenure, to ensure that people can live their lives, because people then might choose that. Why do people choose to move from the private rental sector and either to social housing or to buy their own homes? Because they can't have the security of tenure. They can't plan ahead, because at any point in time, you've got what's known as Section 34, and they're the grounds that a landlord can give you to evict. And some of the pressure that's been put on at this point in time with a lot of the organisations and the NGOs was maybe suggesting a moratorium on evictions. Given that we've got the extent of the pressure, we have an insufficient supply of social housing, we've got a huge affordability crisis, we've got over 10,000 people in emergency accommodation. So as a prevention mechanism, could we put up some kind of moratorium? And of course, this came back to what was mentioned in the very first panel, is that's unconstitutional. And I think the big question that we need to ask is, let's try this, let's put it before the courts, and let's be absolutely clear that it is unconstitutional. And if it's deemed to be unconstitutional, well, then let's change the constitution. But time and time again, no matter what measures we get, when Simon Coveney attempted to look at introducing proper rent certainty, indexing rents, he was told that we couldn't do that because it was unconstitutional.
Which is interesting. And I'm sorry, Neil, but I remember conversations with the now moved aside Ed Honohan in the Master of the High Court, and he had a giggle because he thought, well, why don't we try this? Why don't we put it in front of the courts? Because there's also the right of the tenant is also recognised, and it's recognised by the European Court of Justice as well. And there's been similar cases taken to the European Court of Justice in other jurisdictions that have resulted in contracts being, if you know, your right to stay can actually trump that right, as you say, to private property. Michael, you did a big piece of work a few months ago on which was great in the context of where we are now. And they tell us that there's a lack of supply. We know that there's enough zoned land to build 414,000 dwellings instead of housing solutions. That's the other. You know, the government are great at producing housing solutions without actually building houses. But Michael, you did a big piece of work showing that. You know, it's a myth it's the foreign migration that's coming in. It's the non-nationals, and it's this that we should be afraid of. Do you want to give us your thoughts on where we are and where we need to actually quickly get to?
Yes, I think first off we have to understand that the limitations of the issue of the housing crisis are. Throughout the country. For instance, in huge swathes of the country, house prices are not an issue. Rents are not that much of an issue, though maybe accessibility might be. Now, it's only in Dublin and the main urban areas where this is an issue, though it is bleeding out into surrounding counties as people are moving out. Say, from Dublin, they're moving into Meath or Kildare or Louth or Wicklow because they can't afford that here, and which begs the question of unsustainable work-life patterns in the future. So we have the geographically confined, and then within that geography, there's a very high percentage of people who don't have housing needs. They either own or, they have a mortgage, but they're, a lot of them are quite capable of meeting that mortgage without undue strain. So even within those areas, we find that actually the crisis, acute as it is limited, which, makes, I think, people frustrated that the issue of housing isn't further up the political agenda as it should be. And as we've seen over the last few years, as housing needs have increased, homelessness increased, rents and prices have gone through the roof, actually the support for the two center-right parties has also increased. So, it gets frustrating that. Therefore, the key in any kind of political strategy, working off a good economic solution, would be to link as many people who have housing needs, but they're different because, it's different from if you're on a waiting list than if you're actually in the private rent sector or you're homeless and all that. So there are different needs. So we need to find a common platform that can, accommodate as many of those needs as possible. And to my mind, that common platform is cost rental. cost rental housing. I mean, I think that holds the key for two reasons. One, cost rental, certainly what SIPTU has campaigned on, and I know so many others, this is public housing for all. So cost rental is open to anybody. There's no means testing. It's not like social housing, which has a means test. There's no means testing. So it breaks that divide between the idea that somehow social or public housing is for the poor, and, you know, then everyone else has to...
Destigmatizes it.
Yeah, it destigmatizes it. Secondly, it does something quite revolutionary, but in kind of very, you know, cautious language, but it actually removes private profit from housing. If you are renting out something at cost, okay, you might have a bit of surplus for a sinking fund or to invest into new housing, but if you're renting out something at cost, by definition, you're removing profit, which, of course, would be quite a revolutionary development here in this country. So a cost rental would seem to address in so much. It can appeal to those on the waiting list. It can appeal to the low income earner, the average income earner. There are different kind. There are different models of cost rental. But that would seem to be the key thing. And also, I think that we have to pay, we will have to in the future pay more attention to the idea of affordable home purchase or kind of a cost purchase. Because, you know, at the end of the day, home ownership is a natural thing when you get into a particular type of life cycle. And as Lorcan has pointed out, it is a, you know, it means that your housing is by and large usually free once you're retired. So housing does not become a burden on that. Now, obviously, in a, any kind of scheme like that, you'd have to work it out. But that's how you can, you have, that's how you can unite all, as many of these needs as possible onto one platform, and that means you have more people with skin in the game and more people will raise their voice for that one particular proposal.
Very good. Niamh, you want to come in there?
Just on the cost rental, because I think that's exactly where it is at, and I think that's where we have to focus our energy. But I do think it's really important to inject the word affordable cost rental in there, because I think one of the key challenges is cost rental is based on the cost of delivering those particular homes or whatever. So if there's reasons for, I mean, you can come across things like Japanese knotweed and whatever that can increase, which is impossible to, I don't build personally, but I believe that building in an area where you've got Japanese knotweed is an absolute nightmare, and it is prohibitive cost-wise. So the cost of actually building that particular home is actually the cost of so that's what your cost will be based on. So I think we do need to be starting talking about affordable cost rental, and to ensure that every time we're talking about it, we're talking about the affordability piece. And I also think we need to kind of consider what kind of subsidies in relation to that, because obviously there's conversations around land subsidies, but we also need to be talking about subsidies in terms of rent as well, because the idea being is you want to have diverse communities, you want vibrant communities where you've got people with all income types all living in the same estates. We don't want to have this kind of piece where you've got different types of households living in different areas based on income. So to ensure that you have that kind of diverse piece. And I think we'd also really need to challenge this idea of, you know, free gaffs or free homes.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody gets a free home. Everybody pays rent. It's differential rent, so it's based on your income, as it should be. So people pay as much rent as they possibly can. But people in social housing, people in approved housing, body housing, pay rent. Everybody does. And I think we really need to challenge that, because that sometimes is the resistance that we meet when we start talking about social housing and some of the stigma.
It's not sometimes. It's immediately thrown at you.
Yeah.
Give them a house for free. Why should they get a house for free? Lorcan, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Niamh brought up an interesting point there about not getting a house for free. Nothing comes for free. Those horrible units that are being proposed, being developed out in Dunleary, have a cost. They have a profit to the people who are delivering them, but they have a cost to the people who are living in them and everybody who lives around them, and a broader cost to society. Those units are going to be used for temporary short-term lets during the summer. The nightmare of those people who are living around there having thousands of tourists come and go up their street in a location that wouldn't have got planning permission for a hotel in the first place.
Nobody tell Emma.
Hasn't hit home yet. Yeah, and nobody's kind of spotted this. Anyway, they will get there in summertime, in a couple of summers when there's 62,000 Australians and Germans and Brits and Yanks and everything coming and going. They'll work it all out. So that's a real issue. The cost rental thing is really interesting. It is a good solution. So the cost that you pay is essentially based on the cost of construction of the property and a bit of extra to put into a sinking fund for fixing the lifts and the roofs and all that kind of stuff. That requires, in order to mitigate things like Japanese knotweed and keep the cost level across the country or fair across the country, that requires a central or a national agency to deliver that en masse. The government have absolutely no intention of getting involved in housing in Ireland. They do as little as possible in terms of delivering housing. They're out buying houses, but they're very, very reluctant to build. And a lot of local authorities don't actually want to be involved in building housing anyway. So the problem there is they're going to turn to the market. Now, this is where I see things getting scary, and I see it already because I know an awful lot of guys who work in property.
Here comes Dr. Doom.
Yeah, here's it. No, not really. But what you see is international money looking for a home. So the money is running out in terms of building houses for sale and all that kind of stuff. So where do you go next? We're going to invest in social housing. That's something that is always needed. It will be there forever. There will always be financially challenged households who need social housing. We have got shed loads of money. We'll go in and build social housing for the state. And I see international money coming in. But I know they are. They're coming in sniffing around like mad, looking to build social housing all over the country. And so that won't be cheap. It definitely won't be. Like, the people who pay for it aren't the tenants. The people who pay for it are taxpayers. It won't be cheap. And also, they will probably come up with some sort of bastardized version of cost rental. It'll be on a PPP. And it won't be based on the cost of the property either. So watch that space.
Sorry, Michelle, just one thing on the PPP. I don't know if anybody saw, it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, the new Rebuild in Ireland, big announcement of 354 units across 4 different county councils. And it was, let's all get every minister with a shovel and let's everybody go.
How many times has that been announced?
Yeah, exactly. But this was different because it was they were talking about it and they'd ring fenced the money, and I was away and I missed it, and then when I came back and I went, how much is that money per year? Well, 416,000 per house. The state's own department figure said they can build them for 212, and they want us to celebrate 416,000. Let's all get the shovels and the hard hats and the minister for rolling up the sleeves. Oh, guys, give me some peace.
They've been counted as completed probably in 2017. They're in the same figures for years.
Michelle, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I suppose from the student's point of view in relation to you're talking about cost rental and everything, one of the kind of main asks that we're trying to get across to the government would be a great idea is actually to build their accommodation themselves on campus land. So essentially that would be public housing on public land. And the thing with student accommodation is there's a specific legislation around it, Section 50, where you can build the units smaller, it costs less, you don't have to have windows that open, you don't have to have as many apartments to a stairs. It's actually ridiculous anyway. But the government should be jumping on that and actually, providing accommodation for students. At the end of the day, the colleges themselves have an obligation to provide housing if they're going to provide the education, the service in the area. So I think that's something as well. And you touched on affordability as well, but actually, those student accommodation blocks, in most big bills, if they're not students, they actually have to include Part 5 units in it. So that's more social housing as a part of the build. But with student accommodation, you don't have to include that. So that's another bit that's making it even more profitable for these private developers. So that's what would be more beneficial if the government would just take that off the private developers and actually build themselves on campus land.
Well, I come back and say both to Michelle and Lorcan, both of you said that the state won't do this, but the state have set up the LDA, the Land Development Agency. And in that, they've built it out in such a way as that they've agreed that in most aspects, it'll be 50% private, 20% affordable, 10% social, and a mix.
That's not 100, Tony.
Yeah, but what? But there's 30% in there where Fine Gael are saying that they envisage, depending on the electoral district, it'll go up to 70%, Lorcan. Mm. So our money, our land that we own, farmed out up to 90% to private developers with 10% back. It's no different than what we're doing.
You're going to hear a lot about this Land Development Agency. It's three men in a room. We call it the Lads Development Agency. It is really confused. It's chaired by John Moran, who is the Secretary General of the Department of Finance during the crisis. He seems to think it's an urban or a rural regeneration agency. He keeps talking about Limerick, and we need to build in Limerick.
He wants to build. He wants to build roofs over the streets in Limerick for when it rains.
Okay, yeah, there we go.
I'm just joking.
Leave it there. This is kind of what they're at the moment. So there's no legislation, even though they're working and they're taking land off councils. There's no enabling legislation for them to do this at the moment. They're really confused about what they're at. It will be another bastardized PPP that will be twice as expensive as actually every solution that they've come up with is twice as expensive as actually picking up a shovel and doing it yourself. And that's the way they roll. They roll with the market. And the guys in the market come knocking on the door with complaints about viability, which is nonsense, and easy ready-made solutions like a Happy Meal, rather than cooking yourself. And you just buy the Happy Meal, even though it costs a fortune. And that's typically the way they go on.
I remember when you brought the professor, your is it from Valencia came in, and he said to us, they're doing this in Spain as well, but at least in Spain when you can't have a kitchen, it's warm outside. He said it's gonna lash rain and you've no kitchen. Michael, you've made a great point. We need to actually join the dots. You need to talk people. You need to see that it's people who are students, people who are in direct provisions, people who need actually disability friendly, accessible housing. Like, I mean, I remember a year and a half ago when I started this with Lorcan, and Ono Brin came on from Sinn Féin and absolutely read me the riot act for never mentioning people with disabilities, and I've never felt more ashamed in my life. But Michael, you're right. We need to put that. We need to get that those people, those voices, those that across different things and join those dots. Do you see now with the trade unions and the likes of Raise the Roof coming together, do you see more hope for that?
Well, I think when you're on the left, you always live in hope, you know. That's 'cause sometimes it's all there is. So I do think, though, the intervention of the trade unions, I think it is noteworthy. I know my own union, SIPTU, we even have a phone bank kind of ringing up our members to come out next Saturday. I think there's two things that we will need to succeed. There's just no doubt what's going to, you know, if they're allowed to get away with it, there's no doubt what's going to happen to the Land Development Agency. It's going to be one of the biggest transfers of public wealth to private interests since the bank bailout. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe me, if you don't believe me, just go back over the media over the last few days. This government is quite capable of taking 3 billion euros of our money, rolling out a broadband network and handing it over to a private monopoly, all in the name of competition. So, you know, go wonder. I mean, so we have that coming down. So there's two key things. First off, we have to claim the ground of common sense. That is so important. It's a very simple, you know, it's a very simple thing. So that people say, yeah, that makes sense. Go ask anybody, especially those who are renting or, you know, trying to find a place to rent. Ask them, do they think that their rent should be linked to the cost of the house? And they won't even think for a minute and say, well, yeah, that makes common sense. It's doubtful you're going to find anybody who says, no, I think I should pay a higher rent so that I can give somebody, some rentier, a portion of my money. No, they're going to say, that makes sense. Rent it for the cost. So those kind of common sense arguments are key to get across, you know, because we can talk, and I know I'm guilty of this, percentages and numbers and all things like that. We've got to make that common sense argument. That's the first thing. And secondly, we have to show the widest possible group of people with need. And that means those even on average incomes and above average incomes, but who are in the private rental sector, who may be struggling to save to get into the house purchase sector because they're starting a family. From those to those who are just struggling to get a roof over their head for a night, we've got to find, you know, the common policy programs in its simplest form, using common sense arguments to unite all those together. Because if we do that, then we add more voices to it. I mean, I can't raise the roof next Saturday. I don't think any individual here can, but all together we can. And so that's the challenge of political strategy. And the challenge of those who are making the argument for cost rental is to give people the arguments that they can make that they can make in their everyday discourse that makes common sense to people. Those two are so key.
I'm going to hand over to the echo chambers, Martin McMahon, now for he's going to direct questions from the audience. If anybody's any questions, just stick your hand up. Also, Ashton, do you mind if there are questions, can you come up as well in case there are one for yourself? There's experts down the back, but she's hiding away. Orla Hegarty, huh? Lucy, not you, Niall Carson, not you. But if you, look, guys, thanks so much for coming. Really cheeky of me, plug though. We finance this out of our arse pocket. If you do, give us the price of a cup of coffee. Go on to Patreon. We have a Patreon. We could do it. If, honest to God, like this is. I'm looking at this kid here, and I'm going. I'm wondering if I can even get away with adding another few mics. We could really do it. Thanks a lot.
Hi, folks. How are you? Thanks everybody for coming, and I'd like to say thanks to all the guests. It's been really informative to have these people here to talk to us. Is there anybody out there with a question that they'd like to direct at one of the guests? Anybody at all? Nobody. I'm going to bring up a point. Myself and Orla were talking about this.
Give him a chance, Mark.
Myself and Orla were talking during the week, and we were looking at the what we can only call cubicle living that's coming down in Dunleary. So you'll work in a cubicle. You'll live in a cubicle. You're worker drones. That's it, worker drones. No real people, just worker drones. And we looked back at the size of the apartments in Ballymun. And the apartments in Ballymun were big enough to grow a family. And that was the difference. It wasn't single usage housing. Those cubicles, if a woman gets pregnant, you're out. You get a partner, you're out. This is draconian living. It's dystopian. What we really need, if you get off, you go through the tunnel, the port tunnel, and you get off coming out the port tunnel, the first thing you see, cranes. Cranes, cranes, cranes. And what are the cranes building? They're building the most expensive office blocks in Europe. That's what they're building. The most expensive office blocks. Now think for a second, spatial planning, and think of your city. Wouldn't it be much better, much, much better, if they were building a Ballymun Tower down on the quays? So that everything that people need is there. Instead of building it out in isolation, we have no shortage of land in Ireland. None whatsoever. We're the least densely populated country in the EU. The idea that we all have to be in cubicles and cells is outrageous. Outrageous. And I'd ask to like to ask Lorcan, Lorcan, other places in the world, where can we see it done better?
Scandinavia, and no country has it perfect. That's, the housing is a very, it's a topic that is influenced by money, by planning, by regulations, by standards, by architecture, but also by the issues around health, quality of life, equity, transport, all those things. So it is a really complicated topic, which annoys me when I read certain columnists in some of the Sunday papers, and they reduce everything to a simplistic number about we need to build 50,000 apartments every week for the rest of my life, etc., etc. And it's absolute nonsense, because you need to have a kind of a holistic view around this. The countries that tend to have the most holistic view, or where things tend to work better, are countries where their house isn't your wealth. So in Ireland, it's a thing called asset-based welfare, if you want to go home and be nerdy and look it up. But in Ireland, your house is your wealth. So each man, woman, and child in this room, believe it or not, you're each worth €140,000. Half that is in property. And that's how we do it. So half our wealth, our individual wealth, is in housing. If you go to other countries, like Germany or some of the Scandinavian countries, they don't do it like that. Or Belgium. I lived in Belgium. And where in Belgium, the property prices go up 2 or 3% a year, up and down, fluctuate like that. They pay high taxes, but they get services in exchange for that, like free education. They say you don't get the value of your taxes in Belgium until you put your fourth child to university for free. Rory, you got to move there. Until you put all your kids to university, and then you see it. So you have good public transport, free healthcare, all that kind of stuff. But they don't rely on the house. Here, you're given your help. You're helped to buy a house, and that's it. Good luck. Half the people who own houses in Ireland don't have a mortgage. The idea there is they can release equity and put you through university or pay for their Fair Deal scheme. The Fair Deal scheme is predicated on being, you know, a mortgage-free homeowner. So they're the countries where it works best, where you're not relying on that. And this is why, and it came up in the discussion earlier on, people are delighted to see house prices rise. I'm a homeowner in Cabra. I look at house prices going up. I should know better. But I go, Jesus, look, two estate agents opened up recently. We must gentrification. Hoo-hoo, and we're away. It means nothing to me. I just keep paying the mortgage. Like, it's not going to make any difference to me unless I sell the house, which I have no intention of doing. But that's the way it's innate in us, because my house is my wealth. I have to pay for a VHI or whoever I pay for. I have to put, you know, kids through university. I have to do all that kind of stuff out of your own pocket. In Belgium, that was provided by the state, even though I took home less wages than I do here for the same amount of income. But you get the benefits. So the countries where it works best are the countries where we don't have that housing as your financial asset. A very brief but long answer. Sorry.
Thanks, Lorcan. Please.
Yeah, I suppose just what struck me there is I think one of the challenges we have uniting everyone around the common cause of the housing crisis and homelessness is because of that ambiguity. Because people have so much vested in terms of their personal wealth in housing, because that's the way the system is set up. So on one hand, I'm really concerned about my son or daughter who can't buy a home or can't afford a rent. But on the other hand, I've got my home and I'm delighted to see that the local property prices have increased. So there's this kind of conflict that's going on all the time. And one of the things we've talked about lots, and I'm involved in the Home for Good group, looking at the right to housing. And one of the challenges that we found really is, how do you unify everybody? And Michael's spoken a bit, you know, is it a common policy piece which is around, say, cost rental? Is it about the right to housing? How do you get people to see the fact that your son and daughter can't afford to buy their mortgage, your neighbour is being pushed out of their private rental home, and there's 10,000 people who are homeless? So actually, it's the same problem. It's the same issue. And unless we all stand together and unite behind challenging some of that, we're not going to see the change that we need. But I think it's just really challenging to get that kind of unified front. So I suppose that's some of what the March and the 18th is about.
It's very interesting. I think that we have a big problem in trying to unify, and how do we unify? It all comes down to collecting data, and that we need to start collecting ordinary people's views, and that because politics has changed, our ordinary views are not reflected anymore, because I wouldn't believe in half the political parties. I'd be apolitical and wouldn't see my views reflected through their policies anymore. I think that we need to have a people's housing policy that comes from the grassroots up. That can easily be done through a census where we can collect the information, ask people what type of housing they want, what kind of models that we should be providing in the future. When we're talking about the cubicles, I'm just sitting here thinking of Futurama, and I'm thinking of sci-fi movies, and I'm thinking
like future slum.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm really, really terrified of where my children are going to live and how they're going to live. And I think that needs to be reflected through a good questionnaire that comes from the people that will actually show how we can actually change the policies.
Anybody out there want to raise a question? Orla, if you wouldn't mind. Orla, go ahead.
Just a small answer, maybe rather than a question. You've all said you'd like to unify. A very small comment. Everybody's concerned about unifying people behind something. I think one of the biggest obstacles at the moment is a sort of lazy lie that it's not solvable. And it's a really easy answer to everything, is that it's not solvable and this we can work around the edges. It is solvable, actually. Technically, it is solvable.
It's not
Angola. Yeah. So I think that maybe is a unifying theme, that mm-hmm. it is actually solvable.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, just how would you approach the conversation about like social and economic policy around housing with someone who immediately goes, oh, Venezuela, communism, oh, our shelves are going to be bare, we'll all be, I don't know, in a house with like 50 people, which we're practically already heading that way anyway.
Fergus. Yeah, I just answered two words, Fianna Fáil, and what they did in the 1930s and the 1940s and 50s. Fine Gael even did it when they were in government. It was seen as the thing to do for any Irish government, regardless of who was in power, to build social houses. And they did build them, or they got behind cooperatives or voluntary housing groups. So, you know, unless Eamon de Valera went around with a red star on his cap or something like that, I mean, it actually, if you think the argument can be actually based, it's a very, that it's deeply rooted in Irish history, to build that. And in fact, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when we were still, you know, with having fun with the UK, actually, the advances in public housing in the UK and Ireland were far faster and quicker and developed more than in the continent. It took actually World War One for the continent to kick in, you know, again, some very innovative solutions like Red Vienna and all that. But actually, Britain and Ireland were a league leader in terms of public housing and clearing out slums and all that in the late 19th century. So, you know, they can talk about communism, but just talk to them about what Fianna Fáil did themselves over the years. And if I could just segue just one moment, because Lorcan didn't get a chance, but Lorcan brought to my attention a really innovative solution to the rental crisis on the back of the crisps packet that he was eating this evening. Now, so take it away. Yeah. Take it away.
The crisps packet, things are really bad. Yeah. When Tato, Mr. Tato, Senor Tato is offering a competition to live rent-free for a year on a Tato packet. This is really, this is where, how low we sunk. Actually, if you read the small print, which I need my specs, they'll only give you $1,300 a month towards your rent. now, Mr. Tato is rent-free. Yeah. So he's not. A couple of interesting things that the lady brought up there. Where I live in East Cabra, or as we call it on Daft, Phibsborough Plus, where I live in Cabra East, 647, and I noticed because I used pictures of my own housing estate, which was built in 1929, in my lectures about, you know, history of housing in Dublin. And they built 647 houses in Cabra East in about 20 months. In 2015, we built, I think, 78 houses in the country in a year. So we can do it. And the question about communism and socialism, right? The Department of Housing have taken so many powers away from local authorities in the last couple of years. I won't bore you with the details. They can override any development plan, any local authority councillor, any county council, left, right and centre. This is centralisation of power that Stalin would be proud of. So the idea of the government, of Fine Gael or anybody, turning around and saying this is communist is absolute nonsense. What they're doing is, you know, Stalin would actually give them a gold star for it.
Thank you, Locke.
Yeah, I think in terms of responding to that, we have to push back and say, you know, what is the cost of not doing this? And the cost of not doing this in terms of the human cost, the damage and the trauma to children and families and single people who are stuck in emergency accommodation, who are living really difficult lives in family hubs, who are sleeping rough or whatever. That's the human cost. And then there's also the economic cost. Emergency accommodation. We currently have an emergency-led response to the homeless crisis. It's really expensive. So we're doing something that we know isn't the most effective thing in terms of the impact on individuals, and it's really expensive for the state. We need to be moving away from this emergency-led approach. We need to be moving towards a housing-first approach that Ashley mentioned earlier, which is providing a permanent home for people as quickly as possible, and then you provide that wraparound support in their homes, and that's the thing that we need to be doing. But I really think that that's the response. It's the cost of not doing it is really significant, and I absolutely agree with Orla. We really need to push back in terms of saying this is solvable, this is not inevitable, there is another way to do this. And, you know, we want to build as an approved housing body, we want to build. Respond Housing wants to build, enable us to build, because we will build as much as we can, as quickly as we can.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Burr. I'm going to do the man thing and say it's not a question, it's a comment. So sorry, but I'll be really quick. Just to say thank you so much for tonight and for the panelists. It's been really brilliant. And to thank everyone who's been involved in housing activism for the last number of years and for us all beating our drums saying this is a crisis, we need a right to housing, it is an emergency. Because in years to come, when there is a redress scheme, you know, we'll be the ones standing behind those people who've come through this saying, you know, we've been behind you all along. A couple of things. Sinn Féin are bringing forward their private members bill next week on a right to housing in the constitution. So, you know, if there is a momentum behind it, maybe we, if Fianna Fáil get behind it, maybe it will pass. Local election candidates are going around. Fianna Fáil are saying, we support a right to housing. You know, housing, everyone needs housing. We're on the housing side now. The other night, they voted down good amendments to the Residential Tenancies Bill. So when they're coming knocking on your doors, please, please be talking to people. Check that they are actually doing what they're saying, and Fianna Fáil or not. But anyway, what was my last point was I was going to say, that's thanks so much for tonight. It's great.
Thanks, Bear. Anybody else? Anybody else with any questions? Well, I'm not one to drag it out, so I'm going to call it a day. I'm going to say thank you to the panelists. Absolutely fabulous. Thank you for coming. Thank you for everybody who turned up. And remember, everybody has a vote. We can change this. Thank you.